Welcome to Out in the Bay, queer radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. This week, a thought-provoking look at gender. According to author and academic Catherine Bond Stockton, gender is queer for everyone. When she says queer, she doesn't specifically mean LGBTQIA+ queer. She means the dictionary definition of queer. Strange. Gender is strange, she writes, even when it's played straight. In her new book, Genders, Stockton takes a questioning approach and encourages us to do so too. While addressing the when, why, and what of gender, Stockton reveals that gender is always racialized and is intimately associated with money. She dismantles the concept of gender binary, then asks, who's my opposite now? Stockton also argues that our services run deep, much deeper than many of us imagine. Catherine Bond Stockton is a professor of English and the inaugural dean of the School for Cultural and Social Transformation at the University of Utah, where she teaches queer theory, theories of race and racialized gender, and 20th century literature and film. Before Gender, she wrote several other books, including her memoir, Making Out, which was a 2020 finalist for the Next Generation Indie Book Award. Catherine Bond Stockton, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Oh, thank you. What an honor to be here.
So, Catherine, my producer, Kendra Klang, tells me you didn't want to write Genders at first. MIT Press approached you and pursued you, and apparently you wouldn't take no for an answer. What's the story there?
Yeah, absolutely true. They came to me saying, we need a book right now on genders. So many people are trying to understand what seems to them like a new explosion of genders on the landscape. Parents are wondering what's going on with their children. People are hearing from friends and relatives that something has shifted from them and they want to be named differently. So MIT felt there needed to be a book to explain this. And I felt, wow, that is a vast terrain. I don't know if I can condense all of my thoughts on this into a book that is actually fairly short and meant to be pithy.
So how did you go about tackling this huge topic? I mean, because as you said, it's what MIT Press calls its compact volumes of essential knowledge. By the way, a little visual for the listener, the book is small. It's about 5 by 7 inches, just about 200 pages of text.
Yes, won't hurt a flea, as I say. But I think in the end, as soon as I read a very important book by Jules Gill Peterson called Histories of the Transgender Child, I felt I could write this book because Jules gave me the answer that I had been looking for, and that is, when was the concept of gender invented? And that was the thing that was holding me back. You're supposed to tell the history of the concept, you know, briefly in these little books. And I just wasn't sure when to say gender began. I knew feminists were critical in helping to sort of separate the term sex from gender, but I wasn't quite sure where I could pinpoint the origin of this thing. And reading that fabulous book, I learned an answer.
So, what's the answer? I think that's a good place to go.
Yes, that is a good place to go. So it turns out that the answer really has to do with intersex and transgender kids being brought to a clinic run by John Money at Johns Hopkins University. And these were kids who sensed that they did not fit the norms of gender or felt that there was something about their bodies that did not fit the parameters of male and female. So in being brought to Money's clinic, interestingly enough, their issues got taken up by medicine and by biology. And in many ways, particularly the children that were appearing were considered to be plastic enough to be changed by medicine. Now, this is if they were white, so there is a racialized part to this story. Children of color really didn't seem to hold value in the same way. First of all, they weren't as often brought to the clinic. If they were, sometimes they were considered sort of more difficult than white children. But largely, it was sort of like a leftover overlay of eugenic notions about children of color, specifically black children, sort of being backwards in some way, whereas white children, you know, could be improved, could be corrected.
And so the white children were deemed worthy of study.
Yes. In a sense, sort of became living laboratories in this way that Jules explains. And in particular, with these children coming to the clinic, it was clear that they didn't fit the measures of binary sex. And in fact, what we learn is that Money and his colleagues began to see that the notion of binary sex was far more indeterminate than many people would believe. They knew this better than anybody. But what they did was they rolled 1950s norms over scientific data so as to defend against what the data showed. So in a sense, to shore up this crumbling notion of binary sex, they invented the notion of gender. saying that children are born plastic and kind of remain malleable for a certain time, about up to 18 months, said Money. But then children must grow in developmental channels, either male or female. And these developmental channels he called gender. One last point, you might wonder, like, why? Why do they have to move in these developmental channels if their sex is so indeterminate to begin with? And the answer there was to avoid social stigma and psychological distress. So we end up with this amazing circular reasoning where society's forced binary ends up correcting a problem of its own making, and medicine complies against its own research. It's quite a phenomenal story.
And did the word gender not really, you know, was not in the vocabulary before or just not in this context? I mean, I'm thinking of gender in terms of like a German language or language study in general.
Yes. Yes, you're exactly right. That was how the word gender appeared. It had to do it with a linguistic register, but not yet a sexual register having to do with biological sex and the way people express themselves, as we would now say, their gender identity. So you're exactly right. The word existed, but this was a new way to conceptualize what that meant.
Okay. So you quote Anne Fausto Sterling, an expert in biology and sex and gender, who says, quote, by birth, the baby has five layers of sex, and these layers do not always agree with each other. What does that mean?
Yeah, this was very interesting to read about and understand more deeply. So if you think about it, right, chromosomes, gonads, fetal hormones, internal reproductive structures, and then external genitals, these five things are considered to be the five layers of fetal sex. Now, when the baby comes out of the birth canal, we announce it's a boy, it's a girl, based on that last fifth layer that we can see. So interestingly enough, we're lowering this gender cone upon a child's body based on that one last layer of sex. And again, as you said yourself, sometimes these layers do not agree with each other. In fact, the incidence of what we even call intersex might be about as high as 1 in 60 people. So it's far more common that there are disagreements in our sort of biological layers than we might admit. So this question of the disagreement also has to do with the history, as we all know, for intersex kids, where in terms of being intersex, we force the baby's body to agree with itself, or at least we have for a very long time, right? So we see a baby's body with an indeterminate genital configuration and decide that it must be made to be boy or girl. And therefore, what was called corrective surgery being done at birth to straighten out this circumstance, instead of allowing a natural bodily disagreement among a person's five layers.
I know here in California that our state senator, Scott Wiener, has a bill pending which would not allow that kind of decision to be made until the child is a certain age and has some say in it. Have you heard of that going on anywhere else?
Yes, I have. And let me just say what's interesting about that. So, I mean, yay, I think that would be a great bill to have. But notice that we are then sort of understanding that that's an imposition on that child's body. But if we think we have a normative situation, we just impose with mad abandon. So it's a kind of interesting confession that doing something that should require the child's consent is being done with intersex kids. But then I think we could absolutely broaden that question for all children coming out of the birth canal. They're not yet consenting to the cone put upon them, which takes a lot, as you and I know, to get that cone off your body.
It certainly
does. You wish to do that later on. Yes.
Right. So in other words, that's a way of saying, like, even if you you may feel like you're clearly a man or a woman, you may also be, especially on the surface, you may also be like, well, I don't necessarily feel all those ways inside. I don't feel the way society expects me to behave as a man or a woman.
Absolutely. Look at the definition that is most common right now for transgender, right? Somebody who does not feel right and their sex assigned at birth. Now, that's a pretty interesting definition. Doesn't mean you have to have a hormonal regimen. You don't need to have a biomedical intervention or surgery to be defined as trans. Just not feeling right in your sex assigned at birth. First of all, I would say that would define many of us, right? So it's interesting how even the term trans has become a stretchier term, and probably many of your listeners have seen it written out as trans with an asterisk to sort of give a sense of this broad spectrum of diversity inside the very word trans.
Do you have a section you'd like to read that illustrates any of these points?
Oh, yeah, I could just read you just maybe a couple of paragraphs. So if somebody's wondering, you know, how is it that gender is queer for everyone? Let me just read a couple of paragraphs. Gender is queer, by which I mean irredeemably strange, ungraspable, out of sync with male and female, weirdly not normal, since lived gender fails to conform to normative ideals and expectations, even when it is played quite straight. Conventional views try to snuff this strangeness, yet conventional views are strange. Try this on for a very queer idea. Raise two human beings to think they're opposites. Give them opposite traits to embody. Establish different mindsets, behaviors, and interests. Offer them opposite aesthetics to pursue. Then ask these opposites to live together, love together, parent together, as they raise little opposites. Call this marriage as it was intended. Call this normal gendering. Isn't this strange? And then maybe one last little paragraph that may get at this as well. So I'm giving three little scenarios here. I'll just give one of what I call normative strangeness. Consider, for example, one man, one woman. For the sake of argument, let's say I've seen their genitals, so I can vouch that their genitals are different. These are friends, so I haven't seen their genitals. I'm going on faith. He's a white professor. She is too. Both went to Harvard. That's where they met. And both did doctorates in the humanities. Both wear clothes from the Gap or J. Crew, or when dressing up, they splurge on tweeds. Both are ambitious, professionally accomplished, occasionally witty, and relatively in touch with their emotions, you know, at least for academics. Both report enjoying erotic stimulation of the same orifice. Use your imagination. Question, is this couple so much the same in interests, racial designation, job, salary, dress, and even focus on bodily orifice of the same gender, but not the same sex? Are they homosexual in some strange sense?
You're hearing Out in the Bay, queer radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen, speaking with academic and author Catherine Bond Stockton about her new book, Genders, a compact and concise guide to the evolving complexities around gender. So in the book, Genders, you separate gender from sexuality in part by sharing your personal story. So if you wouldn't mind, please tell us a little bit about your journey with gender and sexuality.
Yeah, you know, looking back, and of course, one can never run the counterfactuals or really understand what was going on. But for me, I've realized that there has been quite a collide in my life between the term gay and the term trans. So given my age, I did not grow up with a notion of trans available to me as a child. I think I was finally 10 when I heard the word transsexual, and I heard it as a man could become a woman, this very old terminology that we don't use anymore. And for me, what was interesting is I just kept saying to everybody from my youngest days, I'm a boy, you know, I'm not a girl. But, you know, people kind of pat me on the head or think I'm a tomboy or just, you know, just say, sorry to tell you, you are a girl. So I felt like there's no way getting out of this bind. And of course, because I could not be seen as a boy or recognized as a boy, the other thing I wanted in my life desperately, which was to kiss girls, meant that I ended up becoming two things I have not felt myself to be, a woman and a lesbian. Now, I actually have a very sort of tender feeling towards both of those terms. I have worn those signs for such a long time that even though in a strange way they're not really mine, I have sort of had to live inside the contours of those terms and bend them to my liking. But I think it's a recognition that for, you know, queer folks of a certain age for whom the concept of transitioning was not available in their childhood, it's interesting to look back, and of course, we're never going to know the answer. You know, was I gay or was I trans? Not possible for me to know. I simply knew two things I wanted and was trying to get both. I got one. I was able to kiss girls. I did not get the boy word.
It's funny because I was actually listening to an interview on Utah station just this morning. And in the beginning, it starts out by saying like you were that you are in a lesbian relationship, but neither you nor your partner are lesbians. So
exactly.
I thought that was an interesting twist.
Yes, indeed.
A big point you make in this book is that gender is racialized. There has never been just man and woman. Tell us more about this.
Absolutely. So the way I was coming at my issue in this book was to say that if we take racial history seriously, and my goodness, why would we not, in these United States, we would understand that there have never been men and women in the history of this country. Gender norms in this country have been white norms. So going back to the 13 colonies, right, we already had differential categories in play, black man, black woman, white woman, native man, native woman, and of course in other territories, right, then also sort of other sex genders, as it were. So in many respects, if there have always been at least six sexes in the history of this country, then the whole notion of opposite sexes makes no sense. Who would be my opposite if I were to identify as a white woman? Is a black man my opposite? Is a native woman more opposite to me than a black man? So with more than six sexes, the very notion of opposite sexes falls apart. In addition to which, and this is a complicated point, but even the distinction between hetero and homo cannot hold, because that is also based and built on the chassis of opposite versus same. So interestingly, I don't know why we are not told that the categories boy and girl do not confess their racialized histories when we have those terms in play. So when I say genders, I always mean racialized gender. And when I say racialized gender, I mean gender. That is our history.
So when you talk about the six sexes at the time of the founding of the United States, a black man or a black woman was different than a white man or a white woman or a Native American man or woman because they were valued differently by the dominant society.
Yes, exactly. And partly what I'm saying here is that traces of these racial histories live inside the gendering of all of us. So back to your point, as you'll see in reading my book, the terms sex and gender are so slighty that they keep colliding into each other, being confused with each other. So you could call them genders, you could call them sexes. I want to make the point more strongly by saying there have been times when they have been treated, right, as legally distinctive categories and with all kinds of biological assumptions surrounding them, so that these categories have literally been treated as if they were different sexes as opposed to different genders. But I want to get at the way in which we are still living with these racialized histories. I mean, I think we know that if anybody was questioning that, the murder of George Floyd, all that, you know, has unfolded since that time, hopefully has educated people about how these racial histories are not in the past, not by any means. They live with us very dramatically right now.
So you have essentially dismantled male and female, the male and female gender binary. Great. With this gender binary undone, what's left? I mean, is there something left in its place? And using your words again, who is our opposite and why? And is opposite important?
Yeah, opposite's not important at all. And that is language we should dispense with. I actually myself try not to use the phrase same sex, though it's hard sometimes not to use it. So I get that. But I think what we're seeing already is a tremendous creativity at the level of language. And here I want to say that queer communities and communities of color, and of course, queer communities of color, have always just been brilliant at the level of creativity, right? Creating all kinds of new terminology. Sometimes I call myself a dandy butch, you know, and that seems to stick. My partner might call herself a farm femme, you know, somebody else calls themselves a gay otter. I mean, I think we have shown this tremendous capacity to actually create new phrases for who we feel ourselves to be. That's one thing at the level of words. I think we're also seeing a kind of riot of creativity at the level of surface, right? The way people are wearing their hair and their hair that's mixing with their clothes, or you might have a man with a beard who's wearing lipstick and wearing a woman's blouse, but then wearing men's trousers and combat boots. I mean, we are seeing this type of experiment now, right? We saw this in the 70s. We've seen this at different points in time. Again, queer communities have been very lively on this front. But I think now what we might call fancifully the gender, you know, the general public, the mainstream culture is seeing this all around it, right? Hearing from their very kids that the terminology that parents are using for their children say, no, I'm non-binary. I'm agendered. So I think we will see more experimentation at the level of surface And the last thing I'll say is that I hope that what we could learn to do is when we see somebody, again, if we're sighted or if we're sensing somebody in a different way, that we would learn not to project a series of assumptions and predictions onto a person from the surface that we see. So if I pass some woman and she looks like a normatively gendered feminine woman to me, I'm not going to be presuming that I know what she thinks, that I know what she believes, that I know, you know, what she does in the bedroom. Trying to really sever the sort of surface creativity from the assumption of the internal depths of that human being.
You know, I mean, out here in the San Francisco Bay Area, where we think we're in some kind of a bubble. So we see a lot of that, I suppose. Yeah. And I'm curious, well, in Utah, yeah. Do you see much of that?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. In fact, I think the changes are very striking. And again, I want to say, as everybody in San Francisco would know, you know, we've had this going on for a very long time. What I think is new is that people who would have imagined that their gender is normative are starting to see change all around them. That's the thing that's different. And I think seeing it on a scale that people did not perceive before. Again, partly because there were cool cities and sections of cities in San Francisco, New York, you know, where people did their thing, but it might not have been as apparent to, again, people who imagine that they're normative. But again, I would say gender's queer for everyone. So this is the system, this is the scene for all of us, you know, how we find our way.
You mentioned the many genders of Tinder, and perhaps you named some of them a few minutes ago. Is that what you mean by, you know, some of these labels that we are choosing for ourselves, people are choosing for themselves?
Absolutely. So some of them, you know, common enough that other people join in. I mean, if you had told me that the term non-binary was going to catch on, I mean, I've been using the term non-binary in my classroom with students, you know, since I started teaching in 1987. And that was a pretty academic, you know, deconstructive phrase. Now you run into kids, they're not getting it from a university. They're not reading it in a book. They're hearing it from other kids, and that makes sense to them. So some of these terms are joined by other people, and other people make up terms that just sort of seem good for themselves. And I love that sort of creativity that is happening all around us. As long as we remember, right, that this sort of delightful buffet is not as easy as just like, oh, I am choosing my gender. That sex gender system is for real, and it continues to surround us. So all this sort of delightful movement that we see, this explosion of genders, still is in reference to a binary that is alive and well.
You mentioned gender reveal parties early on in the book. And I have to say that term is new enough to me that when I first heard it, I thought, oh, this is when, you know, like someone has decided on what they're going to be going forward.
Right?
And that sounds to me like
sure.
more of a reason for a party. But
but no,
it's like it's announcing whether a child coming into the world is boy or girl.
Yes, exactly. And can I just point out, because this will prove something that I said earlier, this is the evidence, it seems to me, that people are very confused about the term sex gender, right? Because if you're cutting a cake and out comes the you know, pink icing or the blue icing, I think we would have said, no, you're actually revealing the child's biological sex. But in this case, the word gender is used, so they think they're doing a gender reveal. But it makes my point, because I actually think when we say it's a boy or it's a girl, that really is gender and not biological sex. So there.
And that's what's going to be pushed on those children for as long as the parents can manage to do so, if that's what they
want
to do.
I believe so. Okay. I believe so.
Last thing I want to ask you about. You admit towards the end of the book that you yourself are struggling with the term cisgender and its implications. What is problematic about the term cisgender?
Yeah. And here, you know, one wants to be very careful here, because I totally get and salute why the term cisgender was created, right? Why it was coined. Because why do trans folks have to go around explaining themselves, right? So it's kind of like turning the tables, like, well, you explain yourself, then you're cisgender. If I'm trans, you're cis. But the problem to me with the word cis is, so it actually means on the same side as, whereas trans means across, right? So cis people are considered to be on the same side as their sex assigned at birth. But my point is that matching is impossible. This notion, nobody can really live as a normative man or woman. And I don't really know how we could ever be on the side of our sex in anything other than our surface looks, right, in any sort of rigorous way. And in that sense, I also do think, as I said earlier, I think it's sort of presumptuous if I see somebody passing me to say, ah, there's a cisgender woman, right? First of all, have I seen her genitals? Probably not. So I don't even know what to say about that. But let's just say she comes up to me and says, I have female genitals. I still don't know all that goes on behind that surface. It could be sloppy thoughtlessness, and she just never is thinking rigorously, you know, about this assignment of sex. A rigorous struggle could be underway. She might be using a strategy to give new contents to these terms. So the problem is the sort of presumption of cisgender doesn't make sense, and it seems to promise a matching that I think is not possible. And particularly since I'm committed to the notion that gender's queer for everyone, then it really makes that notion of cisgender an impossibility. And I want to see a severing between that surface and that depth. Last thing I'll say about that is a term that I think I prefer, I think, I'm not sure, is cis surface. Okay, that might work. You know, so for somebody that we know to be a female genital person, and I don't know if that's, you know, weird to know, like what genitals people are walking around with, but take my partner, you know, who will say, yes, she has female genitals, and she would pass you on the street, and you might think she was a normative, you know, woman in some way. But again, cisgender definitively does not fit her. She's been partnered with a big old queer all this time. And she also has ways that in no way, shape, or form match her sex. Another thing that we've already sort of touched on is I think race kind of blows that out of the water too. And the types of mythologies that stick to our genitals would make it really impossible for all these different genders to match a singular sex. So I think cisgender is a term that maybe we need to adjust. Cis surface might be the better way to go.
You know, it might seem from a very conventional usage of the word cisgender that, you know, let's just say roughly 90% of us are cisgender, but really maybe it's just a tiny, if you look at it by the way you're looking at it, it might just be a couple percent, 2-5%, maybe. The rest of us are, you know, like, I don't know, maybe.
Yeah, and I've truly never met the man whose gender actually matches his sex assigned at birth. All the people going under the term men that I've ever met, somewhere in there, there's something that's happening that in no way, shape, or form sort of fits the notion of maleness. I think the very term toxic masculinity would sort of prove that the definitions of masculine and feminine are really confounding. Another example I would just give, if we say, well, you know, masculinity is obviously bravery, I would say to grow another human being in your womb and to have it growing in you for 9 months and then to have to get that grown body out of something called a vagina strikes me as one of the bravest things I've ever heard tell of. So I just don't know where we'll ever get with deciding which human traits are masculine and feminine.
Wow, fantastic. We have to close there. And unless there's any burning thing you want to add, Catherine.
Oh, I would say read the book, write me, argue with me. Professors expect to be disagreed with, and I would love to know other people's ideas out there.
You've been listening to Out in the Bay. My guest this half hour was Catherine Bond Stockton, scholar and author of the new book, Genders. To learn more about Catherine and genders, check out our website, outinthebay.org, where we'll post links to gender and her other works. That's outinthebay.org, where you can hear this show and past shows and share them with friends. Sign up for our weekly email newsletter and subscribe to Out in the Bay podcast. You could also make a donation there to help us keep bringing queer air to your ears. Just hit any donate tab at outinthebay.org. Here's a no-cost way to help. We'd love to know what you think of Out in the Bay. Please send comments about this week's edition, past shows, Out in the Bay generally, or what you'd like to hear on future shows. Send your thoughts to outinthebaysf@gmail.com. And please let us know where you are and how you're hearing us, too. That's outinthebaysf@gmail.com. This week's show was produced by Kendra Klang and edited by Lucen Mendel. Want to join our team? We have volunteer and sometimes low-paid opportunities. Email us at outinthebaysf@gmail.com. I'm Eric Jansen. Thanks for listening, and thanks for joining us out in the Bay.